Just a couple little notes. This is clearly the end, the original ending of the Gospel of John, although there's a 21st chapter that was added later. We know that because it's not in the oldest manuscripts and introduces themes that are really alien to the rest of the Gospel, but it has that great scene with Peter and Jesus, with Jesus asking Peter, "Do you love me?" three times. So it's really important to keep that in mind, namely that the Petrine office is the office of a repentant sinner, and continues to be. I mean, today they're celebrating in Rome the beatification of the Polish Pope, and I think it's certainly important to think that neither he nor his successor nor anybody else have been impeccable, although we tend to assume that. And also John does an interesting thing. He has a kind of anticipation of what Luke will say is happened 40 days later, namely the reception of God's breath, Pentecost. So we can see the theological agendas of each of these writers by looking carefully at these texts. Pardon me. It was Michael Novak who coined that memorable phrase, "The job is not to Christianize humanity, it is to humanize Christianity." Or, in the wonderful phrase of Vercillovic, "to give the church a human face." In contradistinction to what? A ceremonial face? We do ceremonies very well. It's like the royal wedding, you know, the commentator after commentator, the British really do pageantry well. Well, we Romans really do pageantry well, too. But you don't live in a gilded landau or in the midst of all the splendor and choir singing and incense shaking in Vatican Square today. Okay, or we have a bureaucratic face. That's certainly the face of the church that many of us know. Divorced people, women. Or a juridical face. We know that face too. Law and order, obedience, pay, pray, and obey. So how did this happen, that the ceremonial or the bureaucratic or the juridical face is a much more familiar face than the face of this man Jesus, who welcomed everybody, who provided space for everybody? Well, I think this is a reasonable proposition. It took 300 years for the Jesus movement to firmly decide at the Council of Nicaea in 325 that Jesus really was divine. But it was contested for another 100 years until at the Council of Chalcedon in 451 that they finally certified this is the second person of the Trinity. What I'm getting at is fairly simple. I mean, it is not immediate. Jesus didn't go around saying, I'm God. And although some of the scripture writers, John saying, having Thomas saying, "My Lord and my God," even the Gospel of John does not assert that Jesus is divine. It took hundreds of years for that to sort itself out. And the process of that sorting, I think, is really illustrative of the problem I'm getting at today. In other words, they came to see Jesus as divine because they saw this kind of humanity is what God wanted. Jesus was so fully human that you go back to God's intentions expressed in the book of Genesis, where this man really did stand naked and unashamed before everybody else. And I think because the insistence on Jesus' divinity has really eclipsed an appreciation of Jesus' humanity. Clearly, is not stated in the letters of Paul, any of the four Gospels. As I said, it took this Jesus movement centuries to sort this business out. And we still haven't sorted it out completely because to say that this man was divine, what does that mean? Well, we're not going to get into some great Christological argument here. But the fact is that, as I tried to suggest last Sunday, Christianity so often seemed like something that happens to me. Jesus washed away my blood, my sins with his blood. Jesus died for the world. It's over my head. So what I'd like to propose is something that ought to be self-evident to us, but I don't think is at all. Namely, to look at Jesus' career, his death and resurrection, as an event happening to a human being. What was Jesus' death? It was a political execution. It was a murder. Jesus stood athwart the imperial power and even the religious power of the priesthood of his day. Because both of those powers had provided a less than human face to the world, and Jesus stood athwart that. And so it had to be got rid of, because the world could not go on normally in the face of his behavior. So, if you stand back and look at this dead body on this cross, our first reaction ought to be, this is unjust. This is a violation of justice. This poor man who espoused the cause of the poor and women and the handicapped was an irritant, a more than irritant. He was a positive obstruction to life as usual. What we have is an act of injustice, not some kind of divine, you know, prophecy fulfillment or all this stuff that these guys rushed headlong into doing, because the death of Jesus was a scandal. We don't have that sense anymore. Paul puts it very clearly. It's foolishness to the Greeks and a scandal to the Jews, a stumbling block. Because we live in a world where injustice is simply taken for granted. This poor man died, and his death was an act of a violation of the most primitive form of human justice. That's what ought to be the first thing that comes into our heads or our imaginations when we see this man. And if we were able to so twist our heads around that, that that's the first thing that we imagine, the first way we understand, the most primitive level of understanding the death of Jesus as an act of injustice, then the resurrection takes on a larger, richer, and more accurate meaning too. Namely, God is on the side of the unjustly violated. The top 20% of the world population own 87.7% of the world's wealth. 87.7%. The bottom fifth, 1.4%. Second from the bottom, 1.9%. The middle range, 11.7%. This is our world. I'm not talking about first century Palestine. I'm talking about this globe at this moment. And how did that happen? By radical violation by the greedy, by radical injustice that pervades our world right now. This man who came and talked at King's, Martos, the big sacramental theologian, made an interesting point. He said, you know, I don't even think too much about the afterlife. You know, if there is, good. In other words, this nice Very nice man, bourgeois, middle class, author of lots of books, prestigious theological chair. In a very real sense, he's received his just desserts, if you will. Are they just desserts? I don't know. But then I ask him, what about the billions of faceless, nameless people who die every day in the history of the universe, of our world? They can't just go home and put a steak on the grill and, you know. They live on a dollar a day at that. A third of the world population lives on less than $2 a day. What is God going to do about all those poor sods? Well, you see, I think if you turn the resurrection around and look at it from the other end, the resurrection is God establishing justice among us human beings, finally. The God who was clearly on the side of the oppressed and the poor is the God who not just raised Jesus, but who's going to bring equity to those nameless multitudes which constitute the vast majority of humankind. They're going to get justice. They're going to get justice. And we cannot really celebrate the resurrection of Jesus, I think, apart from appropriating that understanding, I think, as even perhaps the most fundamental level of understanding. God will do justice. God will do justice to all these people. And of course, for us, in our comfortable, you know, Huron chapel, nice weather, well, not so nice, but you know, good clothes and warming up, we need to be constantly reminded of the fact that the world is a massively unjust place for the majority of humankind. And the God who raised Jesus is above all the God of justice. A great lady theologian said about the word justice, which comes up over and over and over, it is the very heart of the message of all of the prophets. Huh? There's no accident that Martin Luther King kept quoting Amos, "Let justice roll down like waters from the mountainside, and righteousness." She said that justice is the biblical word for love. I think that's really helpful. And that's where we need to be living, rather than in this ceremonial paradise. Except, I mean, I could see Vatican Square right now with this massive delegation from Poland because they've been flogging the cause of this man, who, like all of us, is flawed. But we love ceremony. We love celebrity. And in the face of all that, it's essential to be able to see beyond that. It is absolutely essential. This is not some romanticism. If this is romanticism, then, folks, the whole thing collapses. To say that God is going to do justice to everybody, then I don't want to have any part of this thing. But if I can't see in every other human being on this planet my sister and my brother, then I'm simply doing not Christianity, but churchianity, which is a whole different thing.